You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYN ads.com.
Valencia is, he's perhaps the best natural politician I've ever met. He could walk into any room, even people who don't speak Polish, and somehow figure out how to get their attention and get them to, you know, to listen, to watch him.
This is Cold War Conversations. If you're new here, you've come to the right place to listen to first-hand Cold War history accounts. Do make sure you follow us in your podcast app or join our emailing list at coldwarconversations.com. Richard Hornick was the Warsaw bureau chief for Time magazine from 1980 to 1981. He carried out numerous interviews with Solidarity Free Trade Union leader Lech Walesa, including his last interview before martial law was declared in 1981. Richard shares the stories of 1980s Poland, as well as the interviews he carried out with the Solidarity leadership and the leaders of communist Poland. Now, if you're enjoying the show, please leave a written review in Apple Podcasts or share us on social media. By telling your friends, you can really help the podcast grow. Now, for $3 per month, and larger amounts are welcome too, you can get the sought-after Cold War Conversations coaster as a monthly financial supporter of the podcast. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate. Thank you so much to our 89 generous supporters who help keep the podcast available for you all to listen to. In today's episode, Richard and I talk about his interview with General Jaruzelski and his meeting with Father Jerzy Popielescu, as well as his challenges with the SB Polish Secret Service. We welcome Richard to our Cold War conversation.
Time magazine had a Vienna bureau of a dozen people. Of course, Life magazine was still around then as well, but they had cars and drivers and photographers. It was a big deal. And of course, that all culminated in 68 with the Czech uprising and the Prague Spring. Mm-hmm. And but after that, aside from a few hiccups in Poland and a couple of other places, Eastern Europe really fell off the map. And so for, I'd say between 1970 and 1980, Time probably had 7 or 8 Eastern Europe bureau chiefs, because people would go there for, you know, be there for a year or so and realize that they were never getting in the magazine. And so they would agitate to get out. And in, so I wanted to stop being the low man on the totem pole in Washington covering business. And I knew that Eastern Europe was coming up. And this was in July of 1980. And so I put up my hand to go, and nobody else wanted the job. And then a month later, this electrician, Lech Walesa, climbed over the fence. And all of a sudden, lots of people at Time wanted to be Eastern Europe bureau chief, but they had already announced that I was going. And so once again, just good fortune.
I'd call it impeccable timing, Richard.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's, you know, no, absolutely. I know a lot of colleagues who were, you know, as talented or more talented than I was, who never, never had that opportunity, who never, you know, that the big story never, you know, came their way. And anyway, so yeah, it was a pretty remarkable turn of events.
So when did you arrive in Poland?
I arrived on early January of 1981, and was trying to I missed all the August stuff that was still covered by my predecessor, a guy by the name of Barry Kalb, who was based out of Berlin, By the time I got there, it was the sort of window to get accreditation was closing, because I was actually hoping to move there with my wife. As it turned out, the first thing that happened to me was I was expelled. I was there for about a week, and I never really found out what happened, but I was there with my predecessor, and I don't think they liked him very much. And so about a week into this, my first reporting trip there, we were in the Victoria Continental Hotel, Intercontinental Hotel on Victoria Square, and it was a knock at the door, and it was we were in the telex room, and it was the manager of the hotel telling us that there were two police out there looking for us. And we were taken to a police station and told to bring our passports. And after an hour or so, our passports, our visas were stamped nulla vana. The visas were annulled. And we were given 24 hours to get out. I was allowed to leave without incident. My colleague, we were flying on the same flight. He was held and searched for quite a while before they let him go, just as the plane doors were closing for the flight to Frankfurt. So it wasn't a very promising start to my career in Eastern Europe. So for the next 3 months, I did what I could from Berlin. We had a couple of stringers, both Polish and Western, in Warsaw. We had experts on the outside. We had people like at Radio Free Europe who were monitoring Polish radio broadcasts and that sort of thing. I read the FBIS.
What's the FBIS?
So BBC and the U.S. Commerce Department had a joint venture in monitoring Eastern media. They had big antennas all over, Germany and I think mostly Germany. But also for China. I mean, this was done all over the world. And they recorded every major broadcast possible, and some were translated. So I think it's the Foreign Broadcast Information Service.
Okay, so this was like a digest of the news.
Yeah. It was more than a digest, because they were actual full. They didn't edit it very much. It was just, these were transcripts of things. Anyway, so it was the usual, the old fashioned, Kremlinology over the horizon thing. Anyway, after about 3 months, we wound up. My wife and I wound up going back to Vienna, because that's where we knew. So we moved into an apartment there, and then I I traveled around the region, covering whatever was happening. For instance, Kosovo blew up at that point. Then Pristina, there were anti-government riots. I covered Poland as best I could. And then starting in April or late March, I was given, one or two week visas to Poland every couple of weeks. And that went on until the end of the year, when in the beginning of November, the foreign ministry issued me a permanent accreditation for to actually move to Warsaw.
Okay. Just let me ask you, I just want to ask you about when you're on these short-term visas, who were you speaking to in Poland? Because at that time, Solidarity was still authorized. So presumably you were getting interviews from their senior people.
Oh yeah. I mean, and senior government people as well. It was not that difficult to find people to talk to. It was really difficult to figure out, actually, in some ways, what the heck was going on, because so many of the versions of from, you know, from what people were saying conflicted with each other. You know, Solidarity was not all that solid. It had lots of factions, and even within the government, there were, you know, and the party, there were factions. So again, it was sort of a triangulation of information. And, you know, be honest, most of what people did between, I'd say, you know, August of 1980 and December of 1981, a lot of it was just straight news reporting. This happened, you know, because everything else was speculation. And it's, you know, that's a, you're supposed to, you know, connect dots and everything, but it's very easy to get fooled by whatever the main theme of the day is, or what everybody is saying. So I tried very hard to keep my reporting as fact based as possible.
Right. Right. And did you interview Valença?
Several times. Of course, he doesn't speak English, and I don't speak Polish. But I had a spectacular young man as my translator. He actually went on to become ABC News, American ABC News' Moscow bureau chief in the 90s. And he was, aside from being brilliant, he spoke perfect idiomatic English. But he was one of those people who could finish a sentence before you finished it. And he could do that from Polish to English and English to Polish. So it was like having a simultaneous translator. And of course, we taped everything, so it was possible to go back over it and make sure we had things right. But yes, I talked to Valença probably a half a dozen times. And, you know, to be honest with you, not very rewarding. My editors were happy, but you know, Valença is, he's perhaps the best natural politician I've ever met. He could walk into any room, even people who don't speak Polish, and somehow figure out how to get their attention and to get them to, you know, to listen, to watch him. But he's not an intellectual. He never read a book and was proud of it. And so, you know, the interviews were, you know, like I say, good for a nice headline or you know, a poll quote or something like that, but not a lot of light shed. And he was, but, you know, this is especially starting in the summer of 81, around the time of the Solidarity's first national convention up in Gdynia. The whole Solidarity was just coming apart. There were, we think, agent provocateurs, you know, sort of starting job actions around the country. He was always on the road, always trying to put out one fire. He was trying to prove that Solidarity could be a responsible partner. You know, the economy was absolutely collapsing. The windows of stores would have, of food stores would have pyramids of empty tea boxes in them. There was literally nothing to buy. Everything was done through rationing. There was, you know, the place was chaos. There were fears that there wouldn't be enough coal for the winter. And so he was just, you know, scrambling all the time. But the last interview I had with him before martial law was actually about a week before martial law, because Time magazine had had decided to make him man of the year. And as such, you know, I had a lot of access to him. And I had about an hour and a half, 2 hour interview with him a week before he was arrested on December 13th, or yeah, probably actually, I think he was, yeah, December 13th. And again, it was a real mishmash of quotes, but, yeah, it was, we got 2 pages out of it. And it was because martial law was declared the week before the Man of the Year cover came out. The Man of the Year cover had probably eight stories about Poland, and 6 of them were mine, including this interview, which turned out to be the last interview he gave to anybody before his arrest. So again, impeccable timing, as you would say.
Wow. I should ask you for the lottery numbers, I think.
Yeah. Well, I never win door prizes or anything else. So.
did you get any impression that he had a plan as to where this was going to go with Solidarity?
No, actually, that was in many ways the heart of the interview, because I kept trying to get him to explain to me what his vision for Poland was. And it was always just a negative, not what the communists are doing. And in fact, the most interesting quote I ever got from him, and, you know, maybe anybody ever got from him, was, you know, after about 20 minutes of going back and forth on this, he finally said, look, you know, you can't expect us to have the proper language. We've spent 40 years in a bad school. All we know is what the communists taught us. And so we have to invent something new ourselves. So, no, I mean, he was, like I say, he was a very instinctual politician. After I got out, I left Poland about a week after martial law was declared. It was Christmas. I left on Christmas Eve, and then went back 2 days later because I wanted to get back in before the magazine came out, because I had been threatened by the government that if we put Wałęsa on the cover, it would be, you know, the end of my visa. So anyway, I wanted to get back in at least and have them expel me. I had to leave, by the way, because they had shut down everything. They had literally pulled the plug on the central telephone and telex switching stations. And so there was no communication outside to the outside world. And the only internal communication were military lines. But anyway, so I did get back in, and they didn't expel me. But there was, you know, complete censorship.
I just want to go back to some of the people you interviewed, if that's okay.
Sure.
You mentioned, you know, the factionalization of Solidarity, and, you know, I agree with you that it was far from what the name implied. But obviously one of the faction leaders was Jacek Kuron, I think the head of the Workers' Defense organization. Did you interview him?
Yeah. You know, actually, the brain trust around Wałęsa, Kuron, Onyszkiewicz, Geremek, Bujak, they were all pretty much on the same page in 1981. The real problem were the regional leaders, and, you know, the people who ran the Solidarity chapters at Ursus, the tractor factory, or, you know, they were the more radical ones. So yeah, no, they were all pretty,
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Libsyn Ads. Go to libsynads.com now. That's LIBSYNads.com.
They're fairly much on the same page. The tactical things, but...
We'll be back after a quick break.
Hi, I'm Steve Windus, host of Batting the Breeze, the podcast for the infinitely curious. I've met people from all around the world with incredible stories to tell. Alistair reveals what it's like to breathe through someone else's lungs. Edward shares some hilarious stories about running for Parliament and what did happen to Winston Churchill's budgie. We always try to be a little bit informative, amusing, thought-provoking, and above all, leave a smile on your face. So why not join me each week batting the breeze? Subscribe right now on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you normally get your podcasts.
But as far as vision, did they have any more or give any indication of any more vision beyond what Valencia had?
And you're right there. There were, you know, divisions in that, you know, some wanted more market oriented approach. Some were looking to humane, you know, communism with a human face sort of thing. Again, you know, to Valencia's point, none of them had really been that exposed to anything except what they knew. And, you know, they confronted a very, very difficult situation. Their constituents wanted the workers. They wanted low prices and high wages, and there's simply no way to square that circle. And so that's why there were just constant problems. There were food shortages, and people weren't getting paid. And you know, what are you going to do about it? And so it was pretty hopeless from the beginning. The idea on the government side was, and it's never possible to know if this is where they were sincere, but was that they needed to make serious changes in the way the economy was organized. They needed to raise prices. They needed to, you know, let the market work its magic in allocating resources, and they needed more productivity out of the workers, and they wanted solidarity. The government wanted solidarity to provide the cover for that, and solidarity said, "Okay, possibly, but in return, then we want to have a greater voice in how the country is run," and that was the big sticking point. And so, you know, there was this throughout Eastern Europe, there was a social compact, which is we will provide you with a job and a place to live and some food and medical care. And in return, you keep your mouth shut and don't try to get involved in politics. And, you know, that is what had broken down in Poland and was breaking down elsewhere. And then to fast forward to 1989, you know, the roundtable discussion, that was still the issue on the table. And that's, you know, when the whole world changed.
Absolutely. Who did you speak to in the Polish government?
Oh, well, they're the people we'd call the export Poles. Mieczysław Rakowski was, you know, the main kind of conduit. There was a guy by the name of Gornicki. I actually did meet and interview Jaruzelski, Jerzy Urban. You know, the usual suspects. And then from time to time, I would uncover, you know, other interesting people. So because of my academic background, I studied not just Marx and Engels, but Hegel as well. And then spent, you know, the next 30 years of my career going to communist countries where no one had read Marx, much less, you know, Hegel. Because all they were allowed to read was Stalin's short history of the Bolshevik Revolution. anyway, so I found a guy, or my interpreter found a guy who was the head of the ideology department of the Central Committee of the Polish United Workers Party, which is it was their Communist Party. And I used to go over to his office, and he actually had read all these things that I'd read, and we could, you know, have an interesting conversation about, you know, how this would have fit with the Marx's view of or even Lenin's view of the world. And then, my economics background, even though I don't have an economics degree, I always found one of the easiest or most direct ways of finding out about a country or a place was to look at its economy. And so, and most communist governments don't, you know, they're happy to have you do that. So I went to a lot of factories. I knew all of the people in Bank Hanlovi, their foreign trade bank. That was from the old days when I was covering Comic-Con. I had a sort of granular, more granular economic view. I wrote quite a few stories based on those things because, you know, I do think that sometimes the kind of slice of life stories are the best way to learn about, you know, for outsiders to learn about a place. And, you know, Jim Fallows, when he's the American journalist, works for The Atlantic. When he was in Japan in the late 80s, he wrote some of the most amazing slice of life stories that really gave you a sense of what was going on there. So I tried to focus on those sorts of things. And then after martial law was declared, there was, you know, we were pretty much cut off. There were very few people you could get access to. We were in full censorship for 3 months. We did the usual, you know, tricks of smuggling out our stories with, you know, pigeons. You know, people, you know, go out to the airport and you hand a couple of pages to somebody and tell them there'll be someone with a sign from Time Magazine meeting them at the airport on the other side.
Okay. You mentioned interviewing mm-hmm. Jaruzelski. What was that like?
It was strange. He's a very, you know, very stoic figure, I guess. Very rigid. Not a surprise that he's, you know, military. But, you know, one of the things that my abiding sense of the place was that, yeah, there were careerists there, especially people like Rakowski or an Orban or whatever. But a lot of the people on the other side genuinely wanted a better Poland. You know, they just had a different idea of how to get there. You know, I don't think we'll ever know for sure if the declaration of martial law was, in fact, as he claimed, necessary to prevent chaos, which would have led to a Soviet invasion. I know there's recent documentation that indicates that Brezhnev was not wasn't in the cards. But no, he was very obviously intelligent and a decent interlocutor, trying to make his case.
Yeah, he's an interesting character because his eyesight was damaged from him being in a Soviet labor camp at one point, which is why he always wore those dark glasses.
Yeah. They call him Pinochet in Poland.
Pinochet,
whatever. That was the joke. I mean, the best part, and I've left this out, but the best part of the probably, you know, 6 years I spent all told in communist, you know, Eastern in the Soviet bloc were the jokes. You know, you could do a whole separate conversation on on jokes. It's how people kept their sanity. And I used to collect them, especially back in the when I was doing the business reporting. Because how do you get somebody, a Western businessman who's trying to do deals in the Soviet Union, to talk to you? You got to have small talk. So, you know, I would trade in, you know, the latest jokes, and everybody, you know, loved those. So So yes, he was an interesting character. You know, it's, who knows what would have happened if he hadn't declared martial law.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you're right. There were two schools of thought, but as you say, mm-hmm. there's more recent documentation uncovered that Brezhnev really thought that he'd probably make it worse by sending mm-hmm. in Soviet tanks. Right. Of the jokes that you collected, have you got a couple of favorites?
Well, I'll give you the one that, you know, as I said, going to Moscow was always a grim exercise for me. And I flew always on Austrian Airlines, and had these little DC-9s. And I would be at Sheremetyevo after a week in Moscow with my nose pressed up against the window waiting to see that red livery plane land, because then I knew I would be leaving. And at the time, there was a joke about the commissar in the Kremlin, who gets up one morning and it's a beautiful day, and he looks out his eastern window and he sees the sun rising, and he feels moved, and he goes and he says, "Comrade Sun, it's so great to have you rising over the glorious fatherland today. I hope you bring peace and prosperity to our people." And the sun surprisingly responds, "Well, comrade, thank you very much. I'm happy and proud to be bringing warmth and light to the glorious fatherland." And the day goes on, the commissar forgets about, you know, what he said. But then he sees a beautiful sunset out his western window, and he goes to the window and says, "Comrade Sun, I have to thank you for bringing, you know, light and warmth to the glorious fatherland today." And the sun said, "Commissar, fuck you, I'm in the west now."
Now, I have heard almost the same joke regards Eric Honecker.
Yeah.
As well, with the sun, you know, the other side of the wall.
Yeah.
But it's interesting to hear its genesis, possibly,
although you never know. There are all sorts. You know, there are ones about shortages. So my favorite economic one was a commissar is an agitprop commissar is somewhere in the Ukraine. And his job is to try to explain the different stages of communism, you know, of economic development. There's feudalism and capitalism. And then there's, you know, the period of building socialism. And then there's, you know, socialism and building, you know. And so he goes through this, and one of the peasants, you know, raises his hand and says, "Well, I'm sorry, you know, could you, you know, explain that?" He said, "All right, so if in feudalism, you had no shoes. And capitalism, maybe you had shoes, you know, in building socialism, you know, perhaps you had a bicycle, in socialism, you know, now people have cars. And when we reach the final stage of communism, everyone will have their own, airplane." And the peasant is puzzled, and he says, "Why would we have our own airplane?" He said, "You know, I really despair of you people. All right, let me see if I can explain this. Okay, you live here in Ukraine. Let's say that you hear that they have toilet paper for sale in Tbilisi."
Brilliant, brilliant. Just want to go back to your time in Warsaw. I mean, what were your impressions of the city when you first arrived?
Well, as you know, it was destroyed by the Germans with the Soviets' complicity, not a stone left on top of it. And they had done rebuilding the old town. But it was, you know, very gray. And the people were so vibrant, even in the midst of the darkest days. You know, the Poles always had a style to them, more so, I think, than some of the other Eastern European countries, a flair. And, you know, there wasn't a lot of lot to do, a lot of food, but, you know, there was plenty to drink. Anyway, it was an interesting place, and it was, you know, it was intense. You were in the middle of history. And so, I've often said that the middle of 1981 to the middle of 1982 was the best year of my life, because it was so intense. And if you had dollars, you know, life wasn't bad at all. A good portion of the Polish populace had dollars because of remittances from abroad, that sort of thing. And the black market, which was incredibly vibrant. There were always markets where you could buy anything, caviar, or, you know, if you wanted an egg, it was, you paid 10 cents. The official exchange rate in 81, I think, was 30 zloty to the dollar. And the black market rate was 700, which was, you know, great, except there was nothing you could buy with zloty, so it, you know, didn't really matter.
And was it the PVEX shops or something? Yeah, that was the hard currency shops.
Right. And they were, but also the there were free markets around. You know, the Poles had this kind of, the Hungarians called it goulash communism. Poles had a sort of proto free market system. So farmers were allowed to sell stuff for hard currency, or at least quietly allowed. The flower growers were actually the source of most of the hard currency. I never quite, it was covering economics. I always wanted to get to the bottom of that, but I never could quite figure out why they did so well. But you always had flowers.
Hi, this is Rhonda in Virginia, and I support Cold War Conversations because I think the work that Ian is doing is critically important. I think it's vital to record the firsthand accounts of people who lived and experienced the Cold War, because it illustrates history in a way that a book never can. So thank you so much for the podcast. It's my favorite podcast, and I look forward to it every week.
To be like Rhonda and help to preserve these incredible stories of the Cold War, as a monthly or annual supporter, you'll be able to listen ad-free, you'll become one of our community, get the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster as a thank you, and you'll bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate to find out more.
Did you ever feel that you were under surveillance when you were there?
Yeah. I mean, I had bad times. Pushed around by a couple of thugs in the elevator in my office/apartment building. You know, nothing serious. I got stopped several times while driving. You know, in fact, after martial law, journalists started. If we were going someplace, we would try to go in caravans to protect each other. So, funny story. One night, we were coming back from there was an early curfew, but, so we were coming back from dinner, and I was following the UPI correspondent's car, and she gets pulled over by an auxiliary policeman. And we've had other colleagues who then, were taken away for, hours. So I got out and went up to these guys, and it was actually a sobriety checkpoint. And so they said, okay, blow in this bag. So they hand me this plastic rubber like bag that's, you see anywhere except for sobriety, except it didn't have the little glass ampule on it that would turn color if you had alcohol in your system. And so I just looked at it, and the guys just said, blow. So I blow. And I just blow into this thing, and then he takes it and squeezes it under his nose. That was his sobriety test. Yeah. And, you know, of course, we were surveyed the whole time. You know, I used to walk everywhere, and I was walking over to the U.S. Embassy to interview a political officer one day. And I got into his office, and he said, you know, you're going to kill these guys. And he pointed to these two, you know, older, you know, not great shape, because, you know, undercover cops, you know, sort of up against a lamppost trying to catch their breath because I walk so fast. It was there all the time. And you know, it really informed the way I operated, because I knew that if I, you know, especially in the martial law, if I went and interviewed some underground figure, I would be jeopardizing. So I was very, very careful about who I talked to and how I talked. And that, by the way, is how I met Father Jerzy Popołuszko.
In
March of 82, his church was a center for collecting Red Cross packages and other things for the families of the detained. You know, they arrested thousands of people, and they were anyway. So I didn't know him at the time, but I knew his church was doing that. So there wasn't a lot else we could do. So I went to his church and I met him. I didn't know who he was, but he was this, you know, gaunt guy with just burning eyes and this really shabby cassock. And after a little while, he invited me upstairs to a room, and there was a huge easel, and on the covered with a sheet. And he pulled the sheet down, and there were the locations of all the detention centers in Poland, which they were keeping track of. Anyway, I would go there to the church, because you weren't observed when you were in the church, and he was collecting and distributing underground literature, and so which he kept in a bag. Hung outside his window in case, you know, anybody came in, he could, you know, drop it. Anyway, so he, that's where I got all of my underground publications, or a lot of them. I was gone by the time he was killed, and he became much more, outspoken and, public, in the following years. He even officiated at the marriage of a American journalist and a Polish woman. So he had gotten a little more, like I say, public. But he was a remarkable, remarkable man.
Yes, he was. And I'm really pleased that you know, you shared a bit of a portrait of him as you found him in the early 80s. Meeting people like him, how did you, you know, shake off your SB tape?
Well, as I said, for the church, you couldn't. And by the way, people who thought they did, I think, were the most dangerous of my colleagues. And I won't mention any names, but there was one guy who, you know, was always bragging about his contacts with the underground, and then it turned out that his driver was his driver's brother was SB, and you know, God knows how many people he burned. So I would go to the church. No one knew who I was meeting in the church. They wouldn't follow you in there, and. Again, really, there were people who I talked to who were affiliated with the underground, people who hadn't, weren't on the run. After a while, I'd say after about 6 months, the people who were released, they were okay to talk to. But, you know, it was, yeah, I mean, there were great people. Like, there was a guy, an absolute saint. His name was Darius Ficus. He was a well-known editor. And a lot of the creativity and the resistance in Poland after martial law was poured into the underground press. And Ficus did work with the underground press, but he had an above ground press. I don't know if you've ever heard this, but he became somehow and this is what made Poland so great. He became editor of a publication called The Blind Cooperativist. And it was basically an association of blind people who had been taught some trade like broom weaving or something. And he, you know, and he had this monthly publication, and it always contained some kind of, you know, badly disguised political commentary, you know, couched in historical terms or whatever. And then, you know, there was the Catholic papers, and Tygodnik Powszechny down in Krakow, Turowicz is the editor. Anyway, so, you know, there were plenty of people. So since we're in, we've talked about this, I'd like to, you know, share my horseback theory of what the difference was between 1981 and 1989. It was the underground press. It was remarkable because they didn't just print diatribes against the government. They didn't just call for demonstrations. They published explanations on how a capitalist economy works. What's a stock market do? The difference between the American and the French presidential systems. And because they were forbidden, everybody read them. So my theory is that by 1989, the people of Poland were the most civically educated folks in Eastern Europe, maybe in Europe. And so they were far more ready, far readier to navigate the complexities of trying to square that circle that I mentioned, you know, towards the beginning of this conversation. And it was Adam Michnik played a huge role in that, you know, then went on to create this publishing giant, Gazeta Wyborcza. They did remarkable things, and I don't think it's ever quite gotten the credit it gets. And I also, by the way, don't think Poland has ever gotten the credit it deserves for what happened in 1989. Believe me, in January of 1989, if you had asked any Pole or anybody who'd ever worked there, you know, if the Poles could, you know, somehow square that circle and take power and take it responsibly, not go around arresting everybody, you know, you wouldn't have found many people who thought that. They surprised themselves. And if they hadn't, if they had screwed it up, if they had, you know, taken power in September and immediately tried to, you know, change things and put their jailers in jail, the Berlin Wall would have been up for a lot longer. And I think it's a real shame that they've never gotten the credit. They've never, I don't think, given themselves the credit. And I think a lot of what you're seeing today with the current regime is a willful rejection of that history.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you're right about Poland. I mean, there's all the focus on the fall of the Berlin Wall as the, you know, the end of communism in Eastern Europe, but without that touch paper that Solidarity set off in 1980, you know, none of that really, you know, probably would have happened. And the free elections in Poland are almost hardly mentioned in some of the descriptions of 1989.
Yeah. And by the way, you know when those elections were held?
Was it just after Tiananmen Square?
No, same day, June 4th.
Same day.
So I've actually written a couple of pieces called The Other June 4th. Khomeini died that day too, so, or was buried that day. So there was, you know, anyway, it didn't make, you know, it may have made the front page of the New York Times, but it was buried. And if it, you know, hadn't been for Tiananmen, I think, you know, but, you know, by the same token, it may have changed the dynamics inside Eastern Europe.
Yeah.
But yeah, no. And it wasn't, you know, yes, they lit the fuse, the torch paper, but they didn't then blow themselves up. And that to me was the, you know, all of the cliches, you know, the Poles make great fighter pilots and lousy bomber crews. You know, if you get four Poles on a couch, you'll get five political parties, all of that stuff, you know, and they completely rejected those cliches. And then, you know, the economic reforms that Balcerowicz put in place, which squared the circle the hard way. But, you know, that, and they, you know, people put up with it for a long, long time. And it you know, it changed Europe. Anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. No, absolutely. I did have just one other question. How did you hear about the imposition of martial law, and where were you?
Well, as I said, we were, we made Valencia Man of the Year, and I had my photographer, Rudy Fry, was with me. And we were in Gdansk attending the last meeting of Solidarity. And it was pure chaos. There were, you know, everybody was yelling. Valencia was just, you know, off to the side, holding his head, shaking his head. And then during the meeting, probably around 9 o'clock or so, reports started to come in that there were, you know, military movements, AP armored personnel carriers, you know, on the road from Warsaw, you know, but everybody had gotten kind of used to these rumors before. There'd been a rumors of a coup a few weeks earlier when there was a strike of firemen, students in Warsaw. Anyway, and so, you know, 10 o'clock or so, the thing breaks up. And I go back to my my motel and set the alarm, because at 5:30 or 6 o'clock, my photographer, my translator, and I were going to drive to Valencia's hometown, because he had agreed to let us take pictures of him in his home village, and by, you know, the place where he grew up, being a typical Time magazine sort of thing. And at 5:30, there's a knock on my door, and it's Rudy, my photographer. And, you know, we all had those little Sony shortwave radios, you know, size of a paperback novel. And we always, the first thing you did every day was turn it on when you got up and whenever you could. And that's how we found out that martial law had been declared. But before we went to bed, I tried to make a phone call, and all the lines were dead. But that wasn't unusual, because this was a crummy motel, and so I was literally under the front desk of the, you know, the reception desk, and, you know, trying to see if there was if one of the wires had come loose again. But that they had cut off all communication. And so the next day, we ran around and took photos and tried to talk to as many people as possible. And then there was an announcement that all foreigners had to be back in Warsaw by 6 o'clock or something. And so I wrote as much as I could and took photographs of it. And then we took those photos and the photos that Rudy took of the first days of martial law and gave them to a young guy who'd been sent in to be our photo assistant. And the ferries to Stockholm were still running from Gdansk. And I didn't want this kid in there anyway, because I don't think he'd ever been out of the U.S. before. So we put him on the first ferry with the film, as a tourist, and because it wasn't that many, it was just a few roles. And so that's how, and then we went back to Warsaw, and the whole way down the whole drive, it was all, the latest announcements from Verona, the marshal.
And were there many checkpoints you were having to go through on the way down?
Not that many, because there was nobody on the road, and there were just tanks and APCs everywhere. Yeah, that's probably the most depressing 3 hours of 4 hours, whatever it was.
If you like what you're hearing, sign up to our email list at coldwarconversations.com. And we have further photos, videos, and information on this episode in our show notes, which will show as a link in your podcast app. Don't forget, if you'd like to get one of those Cold War Conversations coasters, help keep us on the air, then head over to coldwarconversations.com/donate. And if you can't wait for the next episode, do visit our Facebook discussion group, where listeners just like you continue the Cold War conversation. Just search for Cold War Conversations in Facebook. Thank you very much for listening. It is really appreciated. Goodbye. Not enjoying the ads? Well, you can avoid them by going to coldwarconversations.com/donate. By becoming a monthly or annual supporter, you'll enjoy ad-free listening, become a part of our community, receive the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster, and bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate for more information.